You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He was a welcome presence on ESPN and ABC for decades.
Thank you for watching Outside the Lines. Coming up next, John Saunders and the Sports Reporters.
Thank you, Steve. I'm John Saunders, and these are the Sports Reporters.
During his 30 years at ESPN, John Saunders lived every sports fan's dream job.
The NCAA has stood firm, saying paying players from the money they generate would ruin college athletics. But room, board, books, and tuition are hard to reconcile against the billions of dollars the NCAA hauls in. That's where they may be in trouble. There are laws in every walk of life that protect workers from being exploited. And even if you don't think that applies here, you can't argue. Someone's doing all the work, and someone else is getting all the money.
But even as this one-time Western Michigan University hockey player rose to become one of the country's most popular sportscasters, he secretly battled depression, and he endured personal traumas that are hard to believe. John Saunders finally chose to share his painful battles with depression. He chose to do it through a book, Playing Hurt, My Journey from Despair to Hope, co-written with his friend and ours, Michigan radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And when Saunders died suddenly 1 year ago in August 2016, it was left to John U. Bacon to carry the torch and tell his friend's story. Good to have you here to talk about this. But it's tough. It's a painful, painful read, I got to tell you.
Undeniably so. John spares nothing in this book. And in this book, he will talk about, he does not ask for pity or sympathy. That was important to me. It's not melodramatic, but it's also not being cute. He talks about physical abuse from his father, sexual abuse from his older female cousins, which John was 6 or 7 at the time. And even the kids in high school, by the way, I learned a lot in this book. I don't suffer from any of these things, and you know, knock on wood, lucky. But even that, for example, when you hear these stories about these high school kids who are having an affair with a 25-year-old high school teacher, we joke in the locker room, hockey locker room, you know, that guy doesn't need counseling, he needs a high five. You know, that's the usual mindset. Those guys get messed up for the same reason John did, that sex becomes physical only, not emotional. It's shameful. It's something you keep to yourself. It's mechanical. And that carried with John throughout his relationships. And then you throw on top of that self-mutilation, which is normally associated with teenage girls, self-medication, both using and dealing drugs through high school. Then, of course, depression is the umbrella on top of all of it. So
and
that's
that depression battle. Well, he opens his book with a truly chilling description of driving up to the Tappan Zee Bridge in New York. Tell us what happened.
So, yeah, the story starts with John looking over the side of the Tappan Zee Bridge in New York and considering suicide. And he promised himself that he would only go to the bridge if he would not jump, just kind of case the joint. But he said, as you know, climb over some of the beams and whatnot, he said he felt a strong hand at his back. You know, clearly wanted him to go that direction. And he said what turned him around was not any nobility or the like. It was fear that looking down at what looks like concrete, which water is at that height, he said he did not have the guts to do it, frankly. So that's an alarming way to start the book off. But that tells the reader this is not your average ESPN book. And talking to Mitch Albom about this, he said, you know, I've read plenty of sports biographies. I've read nothing like this. And he was nice enough to give us a foreword for this book. It's not a rah-rah, sports are great, here's my career. This is my life dealing with mental health issues.
And before we talk about what led to this lifelong battle with depression for John Saunders, tell us, how did you come aboard with doing this book with him?
Partly dumb luck, actually. John had been friends since 1998 or so. I was dressing at Joe Louis Arena for Dave Coulier's hockey celebrity media thing, whatever. To my left are the Hanson brothers from Slapshot, the movie, and they're, of course, putting on the foil with the glasses on. They're caricatures. To my right is John Saunders, played at Western, played at Michigan, series player. I'm getting dressed in the locker room, and John's next to me, and we just started chatting. And we stayed friends throughout this whole time. We're going to do a book on Madison Square Garden when he stood up too soon at ABC College Football, blacked out on the set, probably due to his diabetes, falls backwards. And John's a big guy. He's 6'2", 235, somewhere in there. And when he fell back, he hit his head so hard that blood was shooting out the back of his head, I mean, firing. And he went to the hospital thinking, okay, hockey guy, I'll get a few stitches and we'll
shrug
be fine.
It off.
Exactly right. We'll walk it off. John ends up at Mount Sinai in New York for 6 weeks, relearning how to walk and talk and read and write. And this guy's got an IQ of 154. Very bright guy, to say the least. It had been reduced to 102, which is, you know, barely getting by. 10 pegs into 10 holes. It took him 6 minutes to do it. And, I mean, we'll do that in 10 seconds, obviously, or less. So that's how bad he was. One of John's points about the whole concussion thing going on is that concussions themselves do not actually give you depression. That's a myth. Losing your faculties, your short-term memory, your ability to think rationally, which happens with these concussions, that can make you depressed. You're afraid it might not ever come back. And if you're John Saunders and you do what you do, which is you got three guys in your ear, and it's a lot harder than it looks, and John had three records going on in his head at one time during a broadcast. You got the producer, the guest, the thing is scrolling. It's a hard job, actually. It looks like fun, but it's quite hard. If those records get scratched, and John's records were scratched at that point, that job becomes very difficult. And John could always rely on being a top dog, one of the top three or four at ESPN for 30 years. And now you've lost it. Can you get it back? He doesn't know.
And the clouds are there. He takes us so deeply into that experience. So suddenly, a book about Madison Square Garden becomes less important.
Looks pretty small.
But his depression and the battles that he fought through his life and the things that happened to him, nobody really knew that. Very, very few people. So led to him saying, all right, I'm going to write this book, Playing Hurt, and I want you to be with me on it, and we're going to tell them a story. What unlocked that?
A couple things. One, the book I wrote with Bo Schembechler, and he knew Bo quite well, naturally. Bo's Lasting Lessons. He liked that book. He also liked the fact that it sounds like Bo, not like me, which takes about five drafts, people. That's also harder than it looks. But he wanted it to be his book. He trusted me. We had a good rapport. He had talked to me about some of this, not all of it by a long shot, his background. But I knew more than most, and I did not run scared or freak out, I guess. So we started doing it. And we did it in this about 3 months after he went to the bridge, and things were a lot better by then. But he came here to Ann Arbor three or four times to sit down, two or three times, I guess, for three or four days each, to go over all this stuff. And each time your jaw drops. You just can't believe this guy went through all, you can't believe anybody went through all this. And almost any mental health issue out there right now, John probably went through, as I just discussed. And yet, the incredible thing is, I loved sitting down with John. He is such a good guy. He's a great husband, great father, and he's terrified about being a bad father like his dad was. And he's a wonderful father, and his daughters now in their 20s are people you'd want to be around. They're just wonderful people who love their daddy, as they always call them, never dad, daddy, very much. John and I, sitting in at the house in Ann Arbor, his place in New York, or in a hotel sometimes, or agent's offices, we did it all for 5 years. He would make me laugh every 15 or 20 minutes talking about the worst stuff on earth. And I don't know how he did it. And it was not inappropriate. I guess sometimes it might have been a little bit.
Sure, sure.
But in this book, hopefully every 10 or 15 pages, you will still actually laugh. John never lost his sense of humor. And if you don't lose it through all that, you never will. And I miss him on top of that.
Yeah, I bet. Well, I'd like if you would, John Eubanks, to please read us an excerpt from Playing Hurt. And this is going to give everybody a sense of what it was like to be John Saunders with this father.
This is about his dad, of course, who was his baseball coach, tough guy to say the least. And this is at her bidding, by the way. She picked this one out. Cindy, that is. He was not afraid to dress me down in public, but more frequently, his punishments were meted out in private. If he told me to do something and I hesitated or questioned his order, he would furrow his eyebrow, which created a crease across the bridge of his nose. Then he'd slowly narrow his eyes as if sizing up his prey. I knew what was coming next, so I'd start to run, usually for the perceived safety of my room, but that was not very smart because then I was trapped. So I'd grab pillows to protect myself against the blows I knew were coming. When I was younger, he'd hit me with an open hand, usually on any part of my body that I'd failed to protect. I'd duck and dodge and try not to cry. But pulling that off was almost impossible when the guy you thought was Superman had reduced you to a squirming lump of fear. The older I got, the harder he hit me. When I was around 12 years old, my father had returned after a few weeks away and started giving us all chores to do. I unwisely suggested that because he was not around much anymore. He no longer had any right to tell me what to do. And that's when I saw the all-too-familiar furrowed brow and squinting eyes. This time, the open hand became a fist. When he started punching me, naturally, I clenched my hands as if preparing to punch him back. This only enraged him more, and he punched me even harder. As an added humiliation, he punctuated every blow with a cutting remark. Why can't you learn to keep your mouth shut? This is your own fault. Why are you so dumb? Long after the bumps and bruises faded, what stayed with me was a deep, unshakable feeling of worthlessness. Despite all the beatings, I never thought my father was the problem. Instead, I concluded that I deserved them because I must have been a horrible kid. And Cindy, I've not read this since I turned the last draft in a few months ago.
Yeah.
And I did not know I was going to do this today. And I'm choked up because I can hear him
saying this to
you. And I can see him. He was calmer saying these things to me than I was listening to them.
It made me cry as I read it. And there are many other instances where this happens. And you say this warm, wonderful human being that Americans welcomed into their living rooms eagerly for 30 years was able to overcome that. And he didn't tell people for the most part. He did seek psychiatric help at some point.
Crucially. And look, there's one message to this book, and get it loud and clear. Two messages, sorry. One is depression is a disease. You cannot just say buck up and get through it. And
come on, you've got a great life. You've got a dream job.
Cheerleading, we call it in the book. It doesn't help. It's like trying, as we say in the book, it's like trying to cure cancer with cold medicine. It's a different issue. You need to go see a doctor. You need to see doctors. You need to get medication in many cases, therapy and so on. Second of all, though, you get help. It works. The success rate here at Michigan, the Depression Center with Dr. John Graydon and others, the success rate is very, very high, 80, 90%, depends on how you define it, of course. But this is almost always a treatable condition. So the reason we pushed through the last year without John, it wasn't the money, it wasn't this or that, because I made him a promise, and so did Wanda, his wife, and his brother Bernie, that what John wanted to do was to use his life to sacrifice his own privacy completely to help other people. And as Mitch Albom says in the foreword, he planned on living and spreading this message. So we are doing that now.
He was going to talk about all of this.
Eagerly.
Absolutely.
And better than I can.
Something else that really struck me is what John Saunders experienced as a man of color. He grew up outside Montreal where things were inclusive and relaxed. But
right.
Talk to us a little about what happened when John came to Indiana to play hockey.
Yeah. Indiana's not known for his hockey, of course. They had a good club team back then, about to go varsity, they thought. John goes to the dorm at Indiana, and his roommate walks in with his mom and dad, big lineman on the football team, big white guy from southern Indiana. And I'm not going to use it here,
no.
But he says, I can't believe I'm rooming with an N-word.
Oh.
And not even saying it to John, but saying it to his parents as though he's not there.
Because John put his hand out. Hi, I'm John.
Even the mom wouldn't take it. So at that point, he realizes this place is not going to be for me. I can't do this. So he transfers back to Michigan, where Dan Farrell, the coach, first-year coach, then eagerly picks him up at the bus stop. He's a walk-on, not a scholarship player. Getting along great with his teammates from Toronto, many of them. Not a big race thing there, of course, on the team. And now it's the black students, actually, where the problem lies for John. He's walking down the sidewalk with his hockey buddies, two white dudes, and two African-American female students are walking towards him. And they both nod to John, and John's from Canada. He does not know the code. And probably if you're a black student at Michigan in the 70s, you'd know this. You are to nod to express solidarity, that we're all in this together, and I see you and you see me.
He didn't know the social cue.
Didn't know it. So he does not nod. They turn around on him and say all kinds of things, but basically your cracker friends aren't going to help you. You're not better than we are, and so on. And then eventually guys in his dorm, black guys, which is what John called himself, by the way, pull him into a dorm room and basically beat the hell out of him.
So then he went to Western.
Then he goes to Western, and now he does not have a racist roommate, and he knows the code on campus, so he knows to nod. He's now an American in that sense, so it works out very well for him at Western.
How did, as you worked on Playing Hurt with John, how did having to dive into some very terrible memories for the greater good of helping people, how did that affect him? Was it cathartic? Was it painful?
That's a great question, and one I was deeply concerned about because, look, I'm a history major, sports writer. This is not my field. I am utterly unqualified to analyze the medical aspects of this. So I said to John and to Juan, I said, look, you are talking to your doctor now. I'll do one session with you, you know, one writing session, and see how it feels and all that. But then you have to ask if this is a good idea or a bad idea. And I said throughout this long process, 4 years, if at any point, even after we have a contract, this is not in your best interest in any way, we'll eat the money, we'll pull the plug, whatever. That deal had to be like that. It had to be John coming to me because you cannot prod anybody to write a book like this. And I had to have John's back in that sense. But his doctors were very clear early on that this is actually doing him a lot of good. He's very excited about it. It's the thing he's looking forward to most, actually. He's thinking about a career in writing post-TV. And he would have had one, no question about it. And I will say, I was very gratified when John's telling me about his dad, and I say, you know what? He only knocks you down after one of your best moments, after he wins the Little League championship, after he gets a cool house, a great job. That's always when he brings him down. And he passed that on to his doctor, and I'm pleased to report his doctor said, oh, he's good. And I only say that because I was so terrified of this screwing him up. And once I heard that from her, I said, okay, I'm not a psychiatrist, not a psychologist, I'm not any kind of professional, but this is doing him good, not bad, so let's keep going.
Well, I would say anyone who reads Playing Hurt will not walk away indifferent. The inside is spectacular. I'm sure for you, what an emotional exercise with John having died and not being able to share the story as he planned, but you're the guy doing it.
Bittersweet, heavy on the bitter. It's heartbreaking that John's not here. This was his victory lap, not mine. And I was so looking forward. I was telling John about this. Man, when this book's out there, the world's going to give you a big bear hug. You're going to be validated for going through all this. They're going to tell you it wasn't you. It was your parents. It was this other situations. And, you know, John's only getting that his legacy is. But I am gratified. The reaction already to this has been extraordinarily positive from ESPN, from colleagues, from reviewers. It's hitting the spot that we needed to hit.
The book is Playing Hurt, My Journey from Despair to Hope by the late John Saunders, co-authored by our Michigan Radio sports commentator, John Eubank. And thanks so much, John.
Cindy, thank you.